In Rabbi Walter's newly published book, The Making of Halachic Decision, Rabbi Walter leads us through the route traversed through the ages by our greatest halachic authorities. Using a clear, straightforward style, Rabbi Walter explores the history of halachic decision-making, beginning with the Rif and the Rambam, and continuing through the Mishnah Berurah and contemporary halachic works. Comprehensive definitions of halachic terminology are elucidated, along with the laws of ruling on halachic queries and their application. Well, fortunately, I've had the benefit of seeing Rabbi Walter apply these concepts for the past few years, but as recently as this morning, he gave a wonderful shiur on the topic of a person taking one's life to protect others, and also as this afternoon regarding halachos of tachanun. And although I have not read as much as Rabbi Walter's book as I would have liked at this point, but based upon what I have read, I can tell that these are definitely words that come from the heart. Devarim hayotzim min halev. Rabbi Walter's passion for the study of halacha and for the arriving at halachic truth comes shining through. It's something I look forward to sharing with Rabbi Walter as I complete the book, but also just sharing the journey on the path towards halachic truth for years to come.
Thank you very much, Menachem, for your kind words. I see him already being tested what bracha to make on a cookie. Thank you very much to the programming committee, Mrs. Miriam Selman and Mrs. Mary Gottlieb, for organizing this lecture, as well as the plethora of lectures and programs that we have in the shul. It is a pleasure for me to give this first of my talks about my book here in shul. There were a few venues that were being discussed, and I told a few of the people that were asking that I really, first and foremost, wanted to deliver this lecture in shul. Many of the experiences speaking to people and dealing with halachic shailas certainly come to the forefront in a shul setting, and in my position, so certainly it's a pleasure working with you and a pleasure to deliver this talk here. Typically, the first question that I am asked post the publication of the book is, what is your reason for writing this book? Now, the truth be told, that question already I had to deal with when I had to defend the numerous publishers as to how they're going to make money off of my book. So that was really something that I dealt with heavily in the early stages. I don't want to spend the entire evening discussing and answering that question, but I hope throughout the course of this evening's talk, you'll get a sense of what I felt was most important about this particular topic. Let me just backtrack just a bit and try to give you a little bit of a background into where I'm coming from. As soon as the Jewish people accepted the Torah, at Matan Torah, and uttered the words Na'aseh V'Nishma, which means we will do, and we will hear, we will study, we will understand, the Jewish people essentially told the world that we are a people of Na'aseh, that we are a people who do things. We do not just philosophically discuss and come to reason and understanding, but practically we are a people who do things. We fulfill mitzvos, we fulfill halakha. That premise and that understanding essentially followed the Jewish people up until we were committed and forced to write down the Torah Shebaal Peh, with the concern that it would be forgotten. But the Jewish people did not want to lose track of that which we held dear, and that is the doing aspect. So the Mishnah was authored, the Gemara was later authored, and even following Talmudic times, there was still a very strong sense that the Jewish people did not necessarily have the clearest picture as to how to go about fulfilling the halachic practice as it has been understood from simply the Mishnah and the Gemara. That being the case already in the times of the Gaonim, the first post-Talmudic period that we were introduced to, Gaonim wrote many, many piske halacha. Now, today it's very difficult to come by the pesakim and the tshuvas of the Gaonim, the very infrequently referenced. The most you'll come into contact with the tshuvas of the Gaonim is when the Rishonim and the Achronim quote the Gaonim, but they're few and far between who contemporarily, even the times of the Rishonim and even the Shulchan Aruch, don't directly quote from the works of the Gaonim, but they'll quote from a Rishon who quoted a Gaon. But the Gaonim sat down, and they understood as well, that Talmudic understanding and halachic practice did not come to an end with a close and the redaction of the Talmud, but clearly there had to be a farther understanding of the truths of the Torah. Following the Gaonim, the Rishonim wrote much. Classically, the three Rishonim who we in the world of halacha look to the most, and certainly the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, when he authored His Beis Yosef in the second half of the 16th century. So he turned and looked most at the positions of the Rambam, the Rosh, and the Rif. Two out of three of those are Sephardic, Rishonim. The Rif and the Rambam were Sephardic. The Rosh was in Ashkenaz. And those three Rishonim essentially are found the basis of the halachic process as we see it today. Especially in light of the fact that the Beis Yosef, Rav Yosef Karo, in his introduction to his Sefer Beis Yosef, which is essentially a running commentary on the Torah is the son of the Rosh, he there writes in his introduction that the purpose of his sifting through the large amount of halachic literature that exists is essentially to go with two out of those three opinions. Anytime the Rosh, the Rif, or the Rambam and the Rosh would rule in one particular way, that is the way he would come to his conclusion. Truth be told, even following the culmination of the writing of the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah, who also lived, was relatively a contemporary of the Mechaber, also in the second half of the 16th century, that was not the end of the halachic process. There is still a lot more that we have to review. Commentaries and super commentaries were written upon the Shulchan Aruch. Some are more known, some are less known, the Shach and the Taz, the Magen Avraham, to name but a few. Also continued explaining the process of halacha, explaining how the rulings came down from the Beis Yosef to from the Tur, ultimately fortifying what we have as the halachic practice today. This continued and continues until today. There is no end to the amount of halachic literature that it was written and is being written. The example that I most commonly and typically like to bring is a sefer that was written in 1965, the Shmir Shabbos Kilchasa, authored by Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth, just passed away some 6 months ago, 7 months ago or so, was a man who was saved from Nazi Germany, escaped via Holland to Israel, and he wrote a what we call today a sefer kitzer, a shorthand book about all the halachas of Shabbos. Now, why did he do that? What was the necessity of him going through all the halachas of Shabbos? Is it not enough that we have a Shulchan Aruch, that we have a Beis Yosef, that we have a Tur, that we have a Gemara? And we even have a Mishnah Berurah. We even have an Aruch HaShulchan. There's a lot that's been written on Hilcha Shabbos. He understood that in the 60s, maybe people needed a more basic understanding than previous generations. In every generation, there is a group of people who need a deeper understanding, a more fine-tuned understanding. And his approach was to write a very lucid and clear book to organize the corpus of Hilcha Shabbos in a very organized fashion. Now, those of you familiar with the book, it's not such a simple book. It requires a good Hebrew, and it requires an understanding of some of the basic tenets of Hilchos Shabbos. What I find striking is that to date, that book has been translated into close to 6 or 7 languages, including English, Yiddish, French, Russian, and Spanish. Now, that's an astounding thing, not just about that sefer particularly, but it says a lot about the generation that we find ourselves in. We are a generation, and here we are lucky to be living in a fine and lucky, good country where everybody's very, very good to us. And the amount of interest in halacha continues to grow and to soar. If you go into the library, to a good English library, you go to a bookstore, the amount of books of halacha that are written in English is astounding. You could fill just 2 shelves of just Svarim on Hilchos Shabbos in English. It's astounding. Clearly, books are selling, that means people are buying them, people are interested in them. The knowledge base of the Jews contemporarily and their interest in halacha continues to grow and to soar. That's the background in terms of what brought me to look into finding a specific niche that I found was missing even contemporarily in English halachic literature. Because of the advancement and the interest that people did have in areas of halacha and understanding halacha, there was one piece that I found was just a bit missing. And that was in terms of how halacha works. What's the background? What goes into issuing a halachic decision? What is a halachic decision? What's an appropriate halachic decision? How do you come to a halachic decision? Now, truth be told, already in the year 1766, a work by the name of the Yad Malachi. The Yad Malachi is written by Rav Malachi HaKohen. And he tried and was successful in writing a very, very basic and important book which organized all of the tenets and laws and rubrics of all the methodology of Talmudic law, the Rishonim and the Achronim, and how to go about, how the Rishonim went about paskening halacha. In there, some of his chapters include how to learn the Shulchan Aruch, what has to be taught, how you understand a ruling of the Shulchan Aruch. When you open up a book, there has to be rules in terms of how to read the book, how to understand the book. It's not simply a textbook that one is just able to open and to cull information from, but there has to be a way to understand that ruling, how authorities came to their decisions and how authorities rule from that particular book. So Malachi HaKohen in his book, Yad Malachi, really was extraordinarily successful, and that is a place where a lot of people turn to in terms of understanding what the halachos of halacha are. And that was a place where many scholars since have looked to in terms of understanding and broadening their knowledge base of how halacha works. There were other svarim that were written post the 18th century, the 19th century, the Prima Gadim and the Shach, who are two classic commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, also wrote how they come to their halachic conclusions, what brought them to their understanding of halacha, how they drew their understanding, what brought them to their conclusions, and numerous other works were written along those lines. However, to access those svarim is very difficult. To understand what they are really explaining and what their point in understanding of their conclusions are is not so easy. So the thought was to try to write a book that would be contemporary, that would be a bit easier in terms of understanding what it is that so many people are interested in and how people are so interested in halakha. I'm happy to say and humbled to say that there has been a very, very strong appreciation and a very fabulous attraction to the book. I think people are looking for understanding of halacha and what halacha is, and that has been very certainly encouraging to me and certainly continues my theory and thesis that the growth in understanding of halacha contemporarily has soared. What I've noticed since the publication of the book, and this is really what I wanted to discuss tonight, is something that I was very, to a certain extent, surprised by and shocked by. The strongest feedback, and that is the feedback that I would say both positive and negative that I've heard from two different camps, from emails that I've received from scholars, professors, rabbanim, from different continents actually, is what I found to be the hot button topic in the book, and that is the relationship between the Rav and the Shoel. It's a chapter that I, toward the third part of the book, that seems to bring about a certain premise and a certain position that I posit, which is that it's important for the rabbi to have a understanding of the questioner, the person who's coming to the rabbi to ask a question. So I posit that the more the rabbi understands the questioner, the more beneficial it will be to appreciating the back and forth, the conversation and the dialogue between the two, as opposed to there being, let's say, a she'ela and a tshuva, a question and an answer. That's what we usually refer to as a she'ela v'tshuva, a she'elos v'tshuvos. I posit that there's something called a shoel v'nishal. There's something called a questioner and a respondent. That's very different. There's a question that can be posed, and there could be an answer. So if there's a question and there's an answer, so you look in a book, and you solve the difficulty, and you give the solution to the problem. The shoel and meshiv approach, and it happens to be a tshuva responsa written as the shoel umeshiv, explains that the respondent has certain issues that you have to take into account and certain understandings that have to be brought to the floor. Allow me to begin with a story which takes us back some 150 years to the city of Slutsk. There resided a Rav, a fantastic, well-known Rav, Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, otherwise most commonly known as the Beis Halevi, after his well-known two-volume responsa that he wrote. This story took place in his early part of his Rabbanus. I believe it takes place in the first year that he was appointed Rav of Slutsk, a considerable and significant city in Belarus. And he got a knock on his door on an Erev Pesach. This story is documented in the end of his Haggadah, Haggadah's Beis Halevi. And there he recounts that an individual came to him and asked him the following question. A blacksmith from the town of Slutsk knocked on his door on Erev Pesach and asked whether or not he was permitted to use milk for the 4 cups of wine. Now, the Beis Halevi brought the individual into his house and discussed with him, why is it that you need milk for the 4 cups of wine? Did the Rav or did your doctor tell you that it is prohibited? Is it dangerous for you to drink wine? The blacksmith responded, no, that's not the issue, but I don't have the money to afford wine for the four cups. This is a town in the diaspora, so he needs four cups for two nights. He has a family, and he wasn't able to afford the four cups of wine to purchase it through wine. The Beis Halevi, Rabbi Soloveitchik, left the room. He went to his back office where he picked up a basket where he held and kept his money and turned back to the blacksmith, entered back into the room, and he gave him 25 rubles. The blacksmith said, "That's not why I came. I wasn't looking for a handout. I came to ask a question." So the Beis Halevi responded and told him, "Okay, I understand. When you're able to repay me, so you'll come back and you'll repay me." And the blacksmith walked away happily. Upon closing his door, Mrs. Beis Halevi, Mrs. Soloveitchik, looked at Rabbi Soloveitchik with bewildered eyes and questioned the propriety of her husband giving that amount of money. 25 rubles, she asked. That, for four cups of wine, shouldn't cost more than 3-4 rubles, she responded. Beis Halevi said to her, "You didn't hear the question that the blacksmith asked. The blacksmith asked me if I could have four cups of milk for the Seder. He's having four cups of milk, that means he doesn't have any meat for the Seder. Because meat and milk cannot be eaten together, this is a Jew who keeps halacha, and as such it must be that he doesn't have enough meat for the Seder. If he doesn't have meat for the Seder, it means he doesn't have meat for the entire Yantav. I gave him 25 rubles to cover his costs for the entire Chag." That's one story. Second story takes us back to the early 1900s into the Geula neighborhood section of Yerushalayim where the Rav of Yerushalayim resided, Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. Rabbi Frank was a very, very well-known posek, a Baal Hora, not just in Yerushalayim and Eretz Yisrael, but across various continents. If you take a look at his responsa that he wrote, he answers responsa from various different communities throughout the diaspora. And it happened that a young girl, an unmarried woman, came to his door and asked and brought with her a chicken. Now, typically today, rabbis don't get chickens at their front door anymore, but that used to be a very common question that the Rav's responsibility were to answer the kashrus of a chicken. And upon visiting and speaking to this young woman, he asked her, "Where are you from?" And she responded, "She's from Shaarei Chesed." Now, anybody who knows the basic geography of Yerushalayim knows that it's probably a 15 to 20 minute walk from Shaarei Chesed to Yerushalayim. However, in the 1900s, under British rule, that was not such an easy task. That was more complicated. That was a difficult walk. The roads weren't paved the way they were today. And as such, Rabbi Frank responded to her and telling her, "Go back to your mother and tell her the chicken is fine." His students who were in the room with him were surprised by the psak that he issued. And he explained to him that this chicken, there are different ways to paskin on it. There's a position that permits the chicken and there's a permission that prohibits the chicken to be used. The fact that this woman traveled the distance from Shaarei Chesed to Geula means that this is a poor young woman. Her family is not a family who could afford to throw out a chicken. If they're coming to me, it means that she wants a kula. Therefore, I posited lahakil on that child. These two stories are very, very crucial in understanding what the person is coming to ask. The Beis Halevi and Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank did not answer the question that was directly asked of them, but they gleaned from the questioner what was really being asked. They understood that there's a she'ela and a tshuva, but they also understood that there's more to the question that's being asked, and that indeed is not just a question when it comes to finances and financial considerations when it comes to a shoel, a questioner, and the respondent, but it is telling of a lot of areas of halacha, how the Rav has to understand what is being asked of him. I'd like to share with you a few responsa this evening from Rav Moshe Feinstein. The reason I chose them is because you very, very clearly see throughout his tshuva, throughout Orach Chaim Yerodea, Choshen Mishpat, and Eben Ezra, that this is an approach that he takes when he answers question, which is understanding really what is being asked of him. I'd like to share with you a few responsa that I think very much proves this position that I try to posit, that the question is not just a question that has to be answered, but also there's an understanding of what is really being asked. In the 1970s, there was a question that existed in Yerushalayim regarding Chazara b'Shabbos. This is not a Hilchos Shabbos here, but just the basic background to understand the background behind the question. On Shabbos, to cook is biblically prohibited. There is a rabbinic injunction not to return objects to a flame. That's called Chazara. However, Chazara is permitted under certain circumstances if one fulfills five particular conditions. We are not going to go through the five conditions this evening. That's for a different class. one of the conditions that permits one to return a vessel to a flame, that means if I take something off of my stove and I want to return it to my stove, the item that I like to return or wish to return must be cooked completely. That's called mevushal kol tzarko. I can't return something to a flame if it's not cooked, if it's half cooked, if it's a third cooked. It has to be completely cooked, mevushal kol tzarko. Question that was raised and was brought to the attention of Shlomo Zalman Orbach in the 70s. Shlomo Zalman Orbach was one of the leading rabbinic authorities or halachic authorities. At that time, he happened to have lived in Shaarei Chesed himself, and he could have answered that question that was brought to Rav Tzvi Pesach Frank. But in this particular predicament, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach dealt with this question, whether it was permitted to return our favorite pastime and our favorite food, cholent, on Friday night. Now, what is the question? Now, the question that was posed to Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach was the bones in the chicken, are the bones in the chicken that are sitting in the chalent, are they cooked sufficiently that one is permitted to return it Friday night? An old pastime is to eat chalent Friday night for some, and then you want to take the chalent off of the pot, return it back to the flame. Are the bones in the chalent from the chicken sufficiently cooked to permit them to be returned? Rabbi Orbach has a tshuva about this, and ultimately he decided to send this question to Moshe Feinstein. Moshe Feinstein was unquestionably the leading halachic authority of the generation, so much so that Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, in one particular response, and a very difficult response regarding Hatzalah and ambulances, and people go out on ambulances, can they return home after they leave on their ambulance and they leave their families? And he says, I don't want to touch this question, that belongs for Moshe Feinstein. And he gives him great, great accolades. And here again, you get a sense that Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach sent this question to Moshe Feinstein to resolve it. But Feinstein deals with it in a very fascinating sociological way, and he explains that it depends what people have chicken in the chalent for. And he describes, in a very interesting way, that chicken is not typically put in chalent in America. He says, even poor people, people who don't have enough money, they're going to have meat for their chalent. They're not going to have chicken in their chalent. And then he says, even if they do have chicken, certainly they're not going to eat the bones. They're not interested in the bones. They're going to want to eat the chicken, not the bones. So therefore, Moshe Feinstein says that the chicken and the bones are inconsequential, they're not important whatsoever, but l'daito kel etzel kol adam, they're not something that we have to reckon with, and even if they're not fully cooked, that doesn't make a difference. You could take the chalent off and put it back, even if the bones are not sufficiently cooked. Moshe Feinstein then posits, however, you, living in Yerushalayim, where the state of poverty is more extreme, I could assume, says Moshe Feinstein, that people there are eating the bones. And if they're eating the bones, that would mean that the chicken bones have to be cooked heavily. And that's how Moshe finishes his halachic analysis of the question. However, there is three more lines in his responsa that for us are crucial. Moshe then says, I don't want to answer this question because I don't know the citizens of Israel as well as you do. And therefore, I don't want to have this question going on my back. You deal with the facts that I have given you. You discuss the issues that I have brought to the table. Now you have to resolve the question because I don't live near your people. I live across the ocean, thousands of miles away. You understand your people better. That's a question that you have to resolve. What's striking is that Moshe Feinstein doesn't feel that he has to fall short of answering the question. He answers the question in a responsible way. He handles the question in a responsible way. But even so, it's not a she'ela and tshuva, it's a shovel and a meshim. So much so that he understands that this is not a question that I can necessarily resolve because there are facts that I don't necessarily know and I want you to handle it. From there, you see the importance of financial considerations when it comes to responding to a question, the importance of understanding the financial background of a particular person who's answering the question. And that's what Moshe says in that particular predicament. He did not want to get involved with the end of the question because there are other facts that have to be taken into account. I'd like to talk now a little bit about the background of the questioner. And allow me to explain what I mean by the background. Where a person is coming from, what his history is, who he is, and where he's coming from. There is another fascinating series of responses that Moshe wrote regarding the kashrus of porcelain, and kashering porcelain particularly. Is one permitted to kasher porcelain? I say kasher, that means to not to do tvilas kalim when you purchase it anew, but when porcelain or china becomes treif as a result of a variety of different ways, is one permitted to put it in hot water? Is one permitted to put it back into the oven to kashrut? Now, the ruling of the Talmud is very clear. The Gemara says, "Ein kli cheres yotzim beibolo la'olam." A earthenware vessel never is able to lose that which went in, and it doesn't lose its status ever of treif. Once it becomes treif, the only way to kasher it is by breaking it. Kli cheres requires shvira. So today we understand that part of earthenware includes porcelain and includes china, and as such, any china dish or porcelain that becomes treif has no hechsher le'olam. The only way one is permitted to do so is putting it into a kiln, putting it into today a self-cleaning oven would permit hechsher of a porcelain or a china dish. But Moshe Feinstein dealt with two particular circumstances that he felt were a bit different. Ramosha understood that there was room for leniency, that there is particular room for a particular heter in this regard. And Ramosha refers to early responsa who permit even kashering porcelain. Many might be familiar, wait 12 months. So where does waiting 12 months come from? So the source of that is a Chacham Tzvi. Tzvi Ashkenazi, one of the great poskim, he allows something called Yishun Yud Beis Chodesh, allowing it to sit for 12 months. It's a very questionable heter of the Chacham Tzvi, how he permits it, why he allows that. It's a responsa and it has to be dealt with. But Moshe Feinstein is aware, and he deals with this in his approach, that indeed there is room to be makil in a particular circumstance. He also is familiar that there's a position of the Baal HaItter, one of the great Rishonim, who says that if you do Hagala, if you immerse the Kli 3 times in hot water, that also has a specific room for leniency. And Ramosha, although he doesn't want to rely on those leniencies, he says the following thing, Mipnei takana sashavim efshar lahakel. What is takana sashavim? Ramosha Feinstein is referring to Ba'alei Tshuva. Takana sashavim means he's concerned that if somebody is a newcomer to Judaism and they have kalim that are very expensive, if they have a dishwasher that's made out of porcelain or china that he is familiar with and that might become thrown out, says Ramosha Feinstein, we're concerned that we don't want that individual to be nervous and that he's going to throw everything away as a result. So Ramosha says, Mipnei takanas hashavim hitiru. We permit it because of that circumstance. Now allow me to explain that just a bit. In Yoredeya, in the area of Kashrus, so very often you'll find the Ramah of Moshe Isselis write the following pithing statement. Mipnei hefse merube hitiru. Because of significant monetary or financial loss, we permit you to use the kli that ordinarily would have been prohibited. Now, what and how is the Ramah able to permit something because there's a significant financial loss? Now, what is a financial loss? It could be somebody doesn't have the money to pay for something. It could be somebody does, and it's a significant amount of financial loss. But there is a concept called hefsed meruba, significant financial loss, that the Ramah very often throughout Yoredeya puts into practice if it's a hefsed meruba, so one is able to use this particular kli. How can he do such a thing? The halacha is very exacting, is extraordinarily scientific, and when the Mechaber, Rav Yosef Karo, rules a certain way, that is the rule. How can Ramosha Islis create this new concept called hefsed meruba? So he himself, in his introduction to Sefer Torah Schatas, which is his particular Sefer in Yoredeya, explains that when the Shulchan Aruch ruled in a certain fashion, he was ruling lechatchila, in the best case scenario. Like we posited already, when 2 out of 3 positions rule a certain way, that's the position we're going to follow. However, the Ramah notices and understood as he went through the Shulchan Aruch that there are other opinions as well on paper and on ground that also hold weight, that are also sufficient and are also important. The Ramah understood and explained that he was able to apply the rule called Hefsed Meruba, there's financial loss, and as such, one is able to be Mekil, one is able to be lenient, because there is another position that Me'ikar Adin, according to the letter of the law, permits it to be used. So the Ramah teaches that Hefsed Meruba, financial loss, is not a blanket leniency, but rather it could only be applied when there is what to be somechan, when there are rules that you can use, that there's a basis for permission because of other authorities who rule a certain way. So Moshe Isselis takes that into account anytime he's ruling on a topic that he feels might be room for leniency, if there is hefsed merubah, you could apply it. So certainly the halacha is not lax in terms of skirmishing and moving out of difficult circumstances and allowing particular predicaments to for more leniency, but when there is a situation of hefsed merubah, so we're willing to go back to the ikar adin. The same thing is true when Ramosha explains this concept called takanas hashavim, that when there is a concern, an overwhelming concern, that somebody might not be interested anymore in continuing his path of returning to a life of Torah and mitzvot, so Moshe says, we go back to the Ikar Din, we'll follow suit and we'll be allowed to permit this individual to do what he is supposed to do according to the Ikar Din. Again, you see that background plays an important role in how to resolve a difficulty, how to resolve an answer, how to understand, to respond to a particular questioner, and at the same time, understanding the background of that person plays a crucial role. Another issue that I have found in the response of Moshe Feinstein is the religious bent of a particular questioner. And this you can find in a very interesting shayla that was asked to Moshe Feinstein, well-known tshuva, regarding wearing a watch on Shabbos in a place where there's no Erev. Generally, what we permit one to wear on Shabbos either is a malbush or a tachshit. A person can only wear clothes in a place that doesn't have an Erev, or wear a tachshit, jewelry or ornaments. The difficulty that was raised by halachic authorities well before Moshe Feinstein, certainly once watches began being made, well, the first watch that came out was a pocket watch before a hand or a wrist watch. A pocket held watch is clear that that's not a malbush, that's not something that we wear, and it's not a tachshit, it's not jewelry, it's something that's kept in the pocket, and as such has the definition of a masui, which means something that is a baggage that you're carrying, that you're not permitted to carry. How about a wristwatch? Is a wristwatch something that is a tachshit? Is it jewelry? Is it an ornament? Is it a beged? How does the halacha define what exactly a watch is? So Moshe Feinstein has a short shuv about this topic, but he deals with the classic sources on the topic and reaches a conclusion that you can't stop somebody from wearing a watch on Shabbos in a place that doesn't have an Erev, in a place that has an Erev, clearly the same way you're allowed to carry anything, you could carry a watch. But in a place that doesn't have an Erev, Moshe was asked the propriety of wearing of a watch, and as such he's not sure how to handle the situation, and he questions whether or not one is permitted based upon earlier sources. He continues his response and he explains that I can't tell you that it's prohibited because there is room to allow for a certain person to do so. I can't tell you that it's also, he says. However, he writes, for Bnei Torah and Yirei Shemaim, however one wants to translate that, he says, I would suggest you don't wear a watch. And then he writes, V'chein ani hore l'talmidi. This is the way I teach my students. So there is another fantastic example where you see in the Tshuvas of Moshe Feinstein that there are different ways to answer a question. For his talmidim, he instructed them in a particular path, what he thought was the correct answer, what he thought was halachically appropriate, but he can't tell somebody else that they're wrong for wearing a watch in a place that doesn't have an Erev, because there is basis for that as well. Clearly you see from these few responses of Moshe Feinstein that there is a very clear directive that the Rav has how to answer a question, not just as a question and as an answer, but rather as a she'ela and a tshuva, not as a she'ela and tshuva, and as a shoel and a meshiv. The role and the job of one responding to halachic questions often can be compared, I would say, to a physician. The physician understands that besides the particular ailment that he or she is being asked about, the body is a human organism where there are a lot of moving parts and there are a lot of things that have to be taken into consideration. When somebody's back hurts them, so it's clear that it's not just a back that you have to deal with, but there are other issues that you also have to take into account. When somebody's right side is bothering them, so you also have to look that there are other ailments that have to be taken into consideration. A good diagnostician is able to assess that and understand that on the bigger picture, not just to look at that particular part of the body, but there are other things that have a relationship to them. When we are answering halachic questions as well, the same approach has to come about. And that is that when there is a particular question that's being asked, similar to the way we described what the Beis HaLevi was doing, the same thing is true when it comes to answering a question. This truth follows through to the shoel as well, to the one who's asking the question. a person who is asking a question, a person who is interested in asking a question and is asking questions. And the reason I stress the importance of asking questions, because if not, we will not have a whole body of Jewish literature. The wealth of shelos and tshuvas that we have, svarim that we have written on the topic of questions and answers, is an entire library full of books, just of questions and answers that were asked to some of the great rabbinic authorities from the times of the Rishonim 800 years ago, 900 years ago, to the Gaonim prior to that, up until contemporary responses that were issued by Rav Moshe Feinstein. So clearly answering questions and asking questions allows the growth of the halachic tradition and understanding of how the halachic tradition works. A shoel, similar to the analogy that I gave about the doctor, would be true as well. When an individual looks for a physician and you try to find the physician who is appropriate, we research that carefully. We try to find somebody who will fit best understand the needs that I have, how I will be able to approach a particular ailment or difficulty. That same approach has to be as well when it comes to answering a particular halachic question. Give you an example in that regard. One of the contemporary contentious areas of halacha is Erevin. The kashrus of an Erev is dealt with throughout the literature of Moshe Feinstein. Is there an Erev in Manhattan? Is there not an Erev in Manhattan? The Erev in Brooklyn? There is no Erev in Brooklyn. The Erev in Kew Gardens Hills? There is no Erev in Kew Gardens Hills. And Moshe Feinstein has enormous literature about that. There's a small example that I want to share with you that brings out the importance of appreciating where the Rav is answering his question is coming from and why it's so important to understand who the rabbinic figure that you are asking questions of is. There are numerous questions that exist in the area of halacha that there are no solutions on paper for. There are questions that the Gemara does not respond to. There are questions that Shulchan Aruch does not respond to. Classically, the two examples that I give that are most contemporary are electricity, for example, is not something that ever existed, that halacha never ever dealt with until the advent of electricity. Questions about brain death are crucial, because they were never dealt with in the Gemara. The Gemara never deals head-on with that. The Shulchan Aruch never deals head-on with that. And when you're trying to find the solution to those difficulties, it's important to know where the person you're asking, where the Rav you're asking, is coming from. There's an interesting question that exists when it comes to Erevin that shows a very, very fine-tuned difference between different Erevin. The rule when it comes to an Erev is that you have to have something called a Tzuras HaPesach. A Tzuras HaPesach means, the Gemara defines as kana mikan, v'kana mikan, v'kana al gabam. You need two lintels and a crossbeam that goes over them. Today, we typically, in a metropolis and a metropolitan Erev, we use the city fixtures, we use telephone poles and the like, and we add structures and fixtures to allow the use of an Erev in a much more efficient way. Now, how exacting does it have to be? How straight do the two poles have to be, and how straight does the pole have to be on top of them? It might sound very dry, but the truth be told, this is what separates a lot of different Erevin, and what gets down to the crux of the issues, what allow different Erevin for certain people to use Erevin, and certain people don't feel that it's appropriate. This question is never addressed in the Gemara. The Gemara simply says you need two lintels and a crossbeam. Kan mikan, v'kan mikan, v'kan al gabem. Doesn't tell you how straight they have to be. A 45 degree angle, a 90 degree angle, okay? If the kan al gabem, if the crossbeam swoops or falls down or sags, is that okay? It's fascinating to see how two of the great postmen of the last generation dealt with this question. It's quite revealing in terms of how to deal with questions that you don't find in the Talmud. Rav Moshe Feinstein reports to his Talmid, this is not written in any of his responsa. The Gemara says that it has to be a kanami kan, v'kanami kan, and kan al gabam. They have to be straight on either side and straight on top. As such, it has to be exactly straight. The Gemara doesn't say that it could have a tilt in a certain direction. It can't fall down. It has to be exactly direct. Were the Gemara to have told us that there's permission to put it in a different way, the Gemara would have told us. The fact that the Gemara says it has to be straight here and straight here and straight across would seem to indicate that if there's any dimensional or there's any change in direction whatsoever, the Erev will be prohibited. Rav Aaron Cutler, on the other hand, has the exact same logic. He says the Gemara never told us that a Erev can't swag or can't fall to the floor. An Erev can't turn in either direction. If it would have told us that there's a problem, then we would have. But it doesn't say that there's a problem if it's tilted in a certain way, therefore it can tilt. A striking way that two poskim dealt with the same difficulty with the exact same terminology and the exact same, exact opposite direction of how to understand the question. Is it straight or is it not straight? Does it have to be straight? Does it have to be straight? The Gemara never said if it has to be straight or not. The Gemara never told us that. Were it to have told us, it would have said it. So each of them take an exact different approach into how to understand that, and as such, it's crucially important to know how your Erev is being built. The Rav of this town built it this way, the Rav of a different town built it a different way. There again, you do see the importance of not the questioner, of understanding the questioner, but understanding the particular Rav's logic, where he is coming from, his background, who his Rebbe was, and why he is responding in a particular way. Another important aspect of the understanding who the Rav is and how he's answering his question, is this a person who's Mekel? Is this a person who's Machmir? What is his basis for where he is coming from? Is this an individual who has a tendency to be lenient? Is this a person who has a tendency to be Machmir? It might depend who his Rav or his Rabbeim were. But understanding and trying to understand and figure out the background of who that individual is crucial. So much so that the Mishnah says in Maseches Avos, "Asei lecha rav v'histalik min hasafek." Make for yourself a rav, establish for yourself a rav, and then you'll be absolved of all doubts. There, the Gemara understands and the Mishnah understands quite clearly that the importance of establishing a rav is no different than the analogy I gave to the physician. Finding the appropriate person to resolve the difficulty has a lot of other factors that has to be taken into account. There's another aspect that's important to bring to the table, and not just in terms of the particular question and answer that's being asked, but in the particular field that is being addressed. There is a statement, the supposed statement that you could find. It's attributed possibly to the Beis HaLevi, I referred to earlier, or possibly his son, Reb Chaim, that you can never find a pasul mikvah or a kosher eruv. That's the statement that I would like to address. Now, that means that every Erev is really pasul and every mikvah is really kosher. What's the basis of that? Now, if you look throughout the literature when you discuss the building of a mikvah, there is a very basic premise that the Rishonim give, and that is we want the mikvah to be built to precision and with complete and very specifics, and we should never be lenient whatsoever. So when it comes to the building of a mikvah, we are familiar that we have many, many, many numerous chumras. We have something called the Bor Zriya, Bor Ashaka, Bor Al Gabe Bor. We have all types of different ways to attribute and to concretize and to make sure that this mikvah is kosher. What's the basis for that? The Rishonim explain, and the Tashbetz explains, that if there's a visitor, somebody who's visiting from out of town, somebody who's in town, we don't want anybody to feel left out, that they shouldn't go to the mikvah because this mikvah is not kosher. We want everybody to be able to go and to use this particular mikvah. Nobody should be left out. So we want to make sure that everybody feels comfortable using this particular mikvah. However, when it comes to an Erev, the same is not true. The Gemara teaches a very basic concept called halacha kedivrei hamekel be'erev. That means that the halacha always follows the lenient position when it comes to Erevin. Why? So the way to understand that, and it's questionable when that principle is applied, is it true only when it comes to the food that's being used for the Erev Chatzeros? Is it true when it comes to the Mechitzos, actually building the partitions around a particular city? But when it comes to an Erev, so if somebody doesn't want to use the Erev, they don't have to. But we have to make sure to establish an Erev that is in existence because everybody needs to use it. We want it to be a viable potential for everybody. If you don't want to use it, so don't use it. But that doesn't mean that should be a reason to disband or disallow others to use it. From these two examples, you see very clearly that there are particular fields that also have a certain bias in a certain direction. If somebody asks a question when it comes to building a mikvah, so the Rav who's responding to that will often, and more often than not, give a very strict approach to the question being asked. We want to make sure that this mikvah is kosher without any doubt, so we will make sure and we will guarantee that this mikvah is kosher, that there's going to be no question about it. The language that the Rishonim use, Mishum Taharasan Shal Yisrael, we're dealing with the sanctity of the Jewish people, the Jewish family. We want to make sure that there are no questions, ifs, ands, or buts, and as such, we make sure that there is an untouchable mikvah. When it comes to an Erev, however, the same thing does not hold water. It does not have to be true. We want to make sure that people are carrying, that allows for Oneg Shabbos, allows people to be able to carry in a particular way that they are comfortable with. If you don't want to, you don't have to. But certainly when it comes to different fields, there is a very basic element that there are stresses on a certain areas, and certain areas do not have a stress. One has to understand what they are asking about, and the rabbi who's answering the particular question also has to know that there are basic themes, and there's a basic precedent that's been established and set up throughout this area. When it comes to other areas of halakhic literature, this exists as well. I mentioned just a bit earlier when it comes to kashrus examples. As I mentioned, the Ramah writes halacha kedivrei hahefseid meruba, when there is a question of loss, of financial loss, so we permit certain leniencies to go by because of that element that we don't want there to be a financial loss. And financial loss is taken into account and must be taken into account. However, when it comes to another area of halacha, for example, the kashrus of the four species, the dal and minim, it might depend on where you're coming from. I would imagine that the Chafetz Chaim, living in Radin, did not see as many esrogim as I did. He certainly never saw as many lulavim as I did. You see and you read the way the European gedolim are writing about lulav and esrog. They borrowed from each other. They used the lulav from last year. Is it still green? Is it not green? Was the esrog preserved properly? Was it not preserved properly? Throughout the Ramah's comment on the halachas of the dal minim, you see very clearly that they were taking a very lenient approach. And the basis for that lenient approach, because it didn't exist, they didn't have the four species. So you had to go back to the a priori rule, which permits certain leniencies, that is mikra din. If something is puzzle, something's puzzle. But contemporarily, when we have an enormous amount, and the commerce is so free, that allows the transportation of everything, including the four species, so a question that arises might not be dealt with the same way that it's being dealt with 50 years ago or even 100 years ago. This to a certain extent explains the background of how to understand a particular question, how to understand a particular answer. It's important and overly important, in my opinion, that the questioner who is asking the question does indeed ask the question, that the relationship is fortified and understood, who you are, what you are asking about, what the background to the situation is. A rabbi not only has to take into account the facts on the ground, what is written, but also what is not written, what is not clear, what has to be understood, and take into account a lot of other variables. Some rabbis who I sat with and who I learned from were able to resolve difficulties within the question that was being asked, similar to the questions of the Beis Halevi would send somebody to a doctor when they asked a particular question. A particular question was being asked over and over and over again. There could be that there's an issue that has to be dealt with. There are medical issues that could come out that are being asked, and one has to be trained and understood what those questions are being asked, how they're being asked, and what the person is really asking. The stress and the importance of knowing who you are and who the questioner is and what the person is asking is crucial in terms of understanding. This is the area where people questioned and found a bit of a difficulty in my approach in terms of sharing this attitude that there is something called a shoel and a meshev as opposed to a shayla and tshuva. And Rav Moshe Feinstein, it's clear that he took this approach. If you look at different response literature, to be intellectually honest, you do see that there were great poskim who did not take this into account as much, or would not have written like Rav Moshe Feinstein did, I don't want to answer this question because I live so far away. He'll answer the question as the question appeared without taking other things into account. Now, certainly before electricity existed, and certainly before the level of communication that exists today, so there was less room to understand when somebody was writing to you something as opposed to today. But nonetheless, you do still see in early halachic literature taking into account a lot of different facts, so much so that contemporary poskim even discuss answering a question via fax, via email, via telephone, that you don't have a good sense of what the person is asking when it's not face-to-face, when you don't see the person, when there's not a correspondence or a question or a dialogue back and forth that leaves the posek at times with a lack of complete understanding of what the question that is being posed to him is. So again, just to conclude, I do think and I do stress that the importance of a solid relationship on both parties have to take that into account. The person who's asking the question has to do his and her due diligence to try to understand the question that's being asked. Why I'm asking this person? Certain Rabbanim have an expertise in a certain field. There are certain rabbis who are known to respond to particular questions, if it's a mikvah, it's an eruv, regardless of the particular field, that is their area of expertise. Just because somebody is called a rabbi does not mean that they have the ability or the knowledge or the understanding or the basis to answer a particular question. That is not a blanket permission for somebody to answer a question. There is something called smicha. The smicha that we have today is not the smicha that Moshe Rabbeinu gave Yehoshua ben Nun, and it's not the smicha that existed previously. So although somebody does have smicha, some people are called doctors, even though they might not have the ability to handle a particular difficulty the same way somebody else is. So it's extraordinarily important to ask a question to somebody who's responsible, to somebody who understands the issues, to somebody who is knowledgeable in a particular field, and certainly somebody who's not particular in an individual field is being irresponsible when he answers the question. Hopefully people who are answering questions know when to say no. The Gemara teaches us, Lamed Lashon Chalom Al-Eini Yodea, person has to be trained to say, I don't know. The more a person knows, the more he's able to answer. If he doesn't know the answer to a particular problem, he has to say, I don't know. And at the same time, the person who is answering the question has to take that into account, who the person is, what his background is, what the financial issues are, what the level of and their religious bent is, as Rav Moshe Feinstein posited. And I hope these few examples sheds light on what I understand as being a very important element, the basic element in terms of the halachic tradition, the continuum of the halachic tradition, the basis of the halachic tradition, certainly there being a text and a very clear set of rules and guidelines how to answer questions, but at the same time taking into account other aspects is certainly a very basic rule, is a basic understanding of how the continuation of halacha should exist.